Thanks to donors like you, Aquinas 101 is setting the world aflame with the truth, but the next season can't be filmed without your help. Dozens of new episodes are planned, but they'll only be brought to life if you make them possible. Your gift by October 31st will bring the truth to students, families, and people around the world. Please use the link in the episode description below to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
My presentation today will focus on the issue of deriving an ought from an is. And to this end, I will first consider the meaning of is within the Thomistic account of human nature, and second, turn to the meaning of ought. And it's in this second section that I will consider both the Thomistic account of law in general and also the Thomistic account of natural law in particular. I don't have a handout. I appreciate those of you who have made them, but I am hopeful that this will help you follow where I am. At the very top, you'll see that it'll change to indicate what section of the paper we're in. A number of philosophers, were you to ask them how to derive ought from is, would likely respond, you can't or don't. Indeed, the denial that you can derive moral precepts, i.e. what you ought to do, from what is often called the naturalistic fallacy or perhaps the is-ought fallacy. A fallacy, of course, is a term that we use to refer to a mistake or an error in reasoning. And the naturalistic fallacy is often formulated either as one cannot derive an ought from an is, or sometimes takes the form of denying that something is good simply because it is natural. Both formulations have at first some intuitive weight. If we reflect for even a moment on how things actually are, we can pretty quickly identify things that are but are not good. Reportedly, over half of students enrolled in online courses during the pandemic regularly cheated. That is, does not mean that they ought to have done so or that students should continue to act in this way. The claim that something is good simply because it is natural also soon seems mistaken. Children dying from neglect follows the course of nature, loosely speaking, but the fact that it is natural makes it no less tragic. I could list out many more examples, but these illustrate the underlying objection concerning moral reasoning from nature or facticity. These and similar critiques are often raised against Thomistic ethics, especially Thomistic natural law. For the purpose of today, I'm going to posit that ethics in general considers the good or bad of human actions, or to put this another way, how we ought or ought not to act, or what we ought or ought not to do. Thomistic thought offers two complementary ways of approaching these concerns, both grounded, I'm going to argue, in some conception of the human person. I'll turn to Thomistic anthropology in a moment, but by way of preview, the Thomistic understanding of the person regards the human as both an individual and as a member of a greater community. As such, Thomas's ethics must concern the good or bad of human actions relative to the individual and relative to the community. Corresponding with these two ways of considering the reality of the human being, individual and member of a greater whole, are two complementary ethical approaches. To put it very simply, and tomorrow you'll be exploring this in greater detail, virtue ethics primarily concerns the good or bad of human actions relative to the individual. It is, after all, the individual who primarily becomes better or worse following the cultivation of his or her virtue or vice. To become more virtuous, the individual must become more virtuous. Virtue, after all, cannot be delegated to someone else. Law, by contrast, primarily concerns the good or bad of human actions relative to a community. This is clear from Thomas Aquinas' definition of law, which we'll consider in a moment, as being ordered somehow to the common good and brought about by some authority in charge of a community. Now, in distinguishing virtue ethics and law in this way, I want to emphasize I'm not proposing that these two approaches are radically different, let alone even separate from each other. What I would like to emphasize at this point, though, is that both virtue ethics and law assume or rest upon a conception of the human being. An anthropology that proposes an objective and essential account of who and what we are. Today, we are concerned with how to derive ought from is, and I do promise to eventually give you an answer to that question. But from the outset, I think it's important to consider how not to derive an ought from an is. In deriving an ought from an is, we do not, we cannot, mean simple facticity. The way that something is might be good, might be bad, or might, in fact, in many cases, seems to be neutral. That all of you are here today is good. Online cheating during the pandemic was bad. It ought not to have been that way. The temperature in this room being now, say, perhaps 72 degrees or so, is all things considered neutral. I can't say that I would notice if it were 1 or 2 degrees warmer or cooler. That we are here, that students cheated, and that this room is this temperature are all matters of fact or facticity. While these facts may be important, in fact, I'd argue it's pretty important to be aware of how things actually are, this is not the primary sense of is within the context of trying to derive an ought. So no, the question must be asked. What do we mean by is in the context of the natural law? And can this notion yield an ought? As I indicated just a few moments ago, the is underlying the natural law's ought is human nature, what the human being is. At this point, we might invoke another philosophical term to refer to what it is we are trying to come to understand, namely essence or nature. Of course, as a good Thomist, I will die on the hill that essence is not the same as existence. There's a real distinction between them. But in this context, I think a case can be made for substituting essence for is. If you will permit me a brief digression, the word essence, a translation, of course, of the Latin essentia, contains within it esse, the infinitive of the verb to be. There is, in other words, etymologically, an inextricable connection between the whatness of a thing, its essence, and its thatness, or its existence. Philosophically, this is because, although essence and existence are really distinct, they are co-principles of a given existing thing. The is, within the question of how we might derive an ought from an is not mere facticity, but rather what a given thing essentially is. What something is leads us to what it ought to do and to be. In the case of natural law, nature refers precisely to the essence of the human, that is, human nature. In presenting his anthropology, Thomas takes care to account for how the human being is both like and unlike all other things, thus neither overlooking nor minimizing natural similarities. One way of identifying the ways in which humans are like and unlike other things is by identifying our genus and our difference. Genus and difference are two of the 5 predicables, classical logical concepts used to describe the different ways in which a predicate may relate to a subject. Genus is a broad class, which includes many subjects, in the case of humans, animal. Species is a narrower class that defines the subject more precisely within a genus. Thus, human is the species, the philosophical species, contained within animal. In order to determine what makes a given species, human, different from others, such as dogs, we might identify the difference, a specific characteristic that distinguishes one species from another within the same genus. In the case of us, that difference is rational. It is genus and difference combined that yield the species. Thus, human species is defined as a rational difference animal genus. In addition to genus and difference are also certain characteristics that, while not included within the definition of the species, nonetheless belong to all members of a species and only to them. To put this another way, these are characteristics that all members of a species have precisely in as much as they are a member of that species. So an example of a human property is the ability to laugh. Inasmuch as we are rational, we can get humor. Inasmuch as we are animal, we have vocal cords. Animal plus rational is the ability to laugh. Finally, there are accidents, characteristics that may or may not belong to any given individual within that species, brown hair, 5 feet tall, in Newburgh, New York, etc. Thus, the predicables offer a taxonomy for defining the human being. Of course, genus species definitions are not only applied to humans, nor for that matter are they only used within philosophy. Scientific classification also follows this general approach. So dogs are defined, for example, as canis familiaris. Canis indicates the genus, familiaris indicating what makes these animals different from other members of that genus, wolves, coyotes, jackals, and so forth. At this point, I should note that genus can be more or less universal in defining the human being as a rational animal. Animal is the proximate genus, the group that is neither too broad nor too restricted, but just right. A more general genus, which includes animal, might be living, and a yet more general genus could be substance, at least substance used in a loose sense. A human being, inasmuch as it is an individual, is a kind of animal, is living, and is a substance. For Thomas, reality is permeated by these varying levels of universality, specificity, and particularity. While it is true that any given existing thing is as such an individual, there is a reality to every individual thing that goes beyond the particular. Thus, it is really true that inasmuch as I am an existing thing, I am a particular individual. It is nonetheless also really a feature of me, the particular, that I'm a member of a species, someone who is specifically the same as every other human, all of you, and also shares a metaphysical sameness with other animals, other living things, and other substances. Given this view of reality, it's no surprise to Thomas's readers that he takes care to relate the human being, in reality an individual, not only to its species, but also to other existing things, proximately to other living things. Acknowledging that there are many different kinds of living things, Thomas begins, typically, by distinguishing between three essentially different kinds of living beings. Plants, which includes all plant life, animals, that is, all non-rational animals, both domesticated and wild, and humans. In presenting these three different kinds of soul, because the soul for Thomas simply refers to the form of a living thing, Thomas invokes the notion of natural powers. There are five genera of powers, genera because each of these kinds include subdivisions: the vegetative powers, sensitive, appetitive, locomotive, and rational. Vegetative powers refer to the various abilities that a living thing has, both the bringing about of vital operations, such as reproduction, and the undergoing of operations necessary to maintain life, such as nutrition or growth. Vegetative souls have vegetative powers and no more. Clearly, though, upon even a moment's reflection, we realize that animals, such as dogs or squirrels, are able to maintain vital operations in their own way, but are also able to perform additional distinctive activities, such as sensing the world around them and being drawn appetitively towards sensed objects. Yet further reflection shows that a number of animals do not simply exist, sense, have appetite, they're also able to move. And then finally, Thomas argues that there are some animals which are able to do all of these operations and, in addition, perform the distinctive activities of reasoning and volition. Rational souls, then, are distinguished from the sensitive and vegetative, or the animals and plants, by the essential possession of the rational powers of intellect and will. In Thomas's account, powers are teleologically ordered. That is, they are directed towards an end. The end of a power, of course, is the end of activity or operation. Each power, insofar as it is the kind of thing that it is directed towards a particular and specific kind of operation. It is in the realization, the actualization of this operation, that the power, which lies in potency to operation, becomes actualized. Now, natural teleology is not, for Thomas, limited just to the discrete ordering of a power towards its end. The human being as a whole is a particular kind of thing, a unified being. And as such, we are a substantial union of matter and a particular kind of soul. And it is the union of these which constitute human nature. This individual, then, inasmuch as it is the kind of being that it is, achieves flourishing by actualizing the various potentials that it has, to be the kind of being that it is, and to bring about the activities that it can perform, inasmuch as it is the kind of being that it is. Now, of course, persons are not persons inasmuch as they perform a given activity, but rather inasmuch as they are the kind of being that they are. Thomistic anthropology is teleological through and through, and it is essential, not functionalist. It is this teleology, grounded in human nature, which informs the meaning of ought in Thomistic ethics. The answer to the question, what ought a given individual to do, depends on what kind of individual we're talking about. Although ought applies strictly to human beings, inasmuch as we have intellect and will, there is a broader sense of ought that pertains to anything that exists, including the various kinds of living beings that we were just rehearsing. This is because all things either measure up to or fall short of their nature. So what is flourishing, for example, for a dog? Living and acting in a way appropriate to dog nature. And what about a basil plant? Well, whatever is appropriate to basil nature. Now, of course, at this point, you should be recognizing that flourishing does not always entail conscious or intentional action. The sense of ought, probably in the case of dogs, and certainly in the case of basil plants, is not conscious, let alone moral. Rather, ought in these cases is directly connected to what kind of being is under consideration. When we look at a basil plant with shriveled brown leaves, such as the one now sitting on my counter in Los Angeles, we recognize that it is not flourishing. It is not existing in a way that allows this individual to achieve the teleology of its natural kind. It's a bad basil plant, naturally speaking. But it's me. I'm the problem, not the plant. Just as flourishing depends on what kind of being is under consideration, so too the behaviors and treatments that conduce to or are required for flourishing depend upon essence. While I might not be particularly skilled at keeping basil plants alive, I do know at least that dumping gasoline on top of them or keeping one in my oven won't turn out well. I also know that basil plants and dogs both require water, but importantly, not in the same way. The idea that human beings are essentially and thus consequently functionally different from other kinds of beings is a core tenet of Thomistic anthropology and the foundation for Thomistic virtue ethics and natural law. The ought grounded in natural teleology remains even if a particular end, or even the overarching end of human life, is not achieved. This is because the teleology, which is the metaphysical foundation for the moral ought, remains in as much as an individual is the kind of being that they are. As I mentioned just a moment ago, ought has particular force and weight in the case of the human, because we alone, among created beings, have the freedom to align our actions with our natural end. Or for that matter, we are the only kinds of created beings that are able to choose to act against our own best interests. In sum, inasmuch as the human being is the kind of being that he or she is teleologically ordered towards flourishing, and this ordering remains even if an end is not achieved. It is because humans may or may not choose to perform activities in alignment with this teleology that Thomas dedicates significant time, to put it lightly, to ethics, the branch of philosophy which considers the good or bad of human actions. Now, while I would like at this point to talk about virtue ethics, I know we're going to touch that later, and so the constraints of time lead me to turn directly to law. Thomas Aquinas maintains that there are both intrinsic and extrinsic principles of human action. To put this another way, he maintains that human actions are brought about, or at least influenced, by things that are intrinsic to an individual human being and things that are outside the individual. Virtue primarily concerns the intrinsic principles of human action, law, the extrinsic. As he explains in the opening question of what's come to be known as the Treatise on Law, law is a rule and measure of acts whereby man is induced to act or is restrained from acting. While virtue is an intrinsic principle of action, law is, in some respect at least, extrinsic. Through the rest of this treatise, Thomas systematically presents, first, a definition of law in general. Second, a delineation of the various kinds of law, eternal, natural, human, and divine. An extended discussion of the old law and various ceremonial precepts. A discussion of the law of the gospel, or the new law, instituted by Christ. And finally, a discussion of the relationship between law and grace. Now, it is impossible, of course, in the time we have together to explore in depth or even to touch on the insights contained within this treatise. And therefore, I'm going to focus on how Thomas defines law in general and then we're going to focus on natural law. Question 90, which I just briefly quoted, consists of four articles. Through each of these articles, Thomas considers whether law is fundamentally rational, that is, if it proceeds from some reason or if it originates from the will. He then considers what law is fundamentally ordered towards, whence law might arise, and the necessity of making the law known to those to whom it applies. Now, the fact that Thomas devotes four articles to the essence of law is, upon reflection, actually quite important, inasmuch as these articles combined present a causal definition of law. Causal, not casual. Microsoft Word still autocorrects that every time. So while there are many different ways to define something, one of Thomas's favorite forms of definition is, of course, the classic genus difference one that we just reviewed. In another text, he reminds his readers that the perfect essential notion of anything is gathered from all of its causes. This quote is taken from his treatment of virtue. But I argue that this is exactly what he does throughout question 90, finally offering a definition of law as we've seen already once or twice, nothing else than an ordinance of reason for the common good made by him who has care of the community and promulgated. Now let's stop and parse this definition. The formal cause answers the fundamental question, what is something? And it's the answer to this question, in the case of law, that law is fundamentally an ordinance of reason. Thomas argues that law must be rational, simply put, because law is meant to rule and measure or moderate human actions. Inasmuch as human actions are essentially rational, that's in distinction from mere acts of a human, the law must be essentially appropriate to the kinds of actions it is intended to govern. Importantly, Thomas notes in one of the replies to an objection in this first article that a law that originates not from reason but from will, that is, a voluntary notion of law, or arguably by extension, a positive conception of law, which is not grounded in an underlying reason, is in reality no law at all, inasmuch as it is inappropriate to the kinds of actions it is intended to moderate. The final cause answers the fundamental question, what is something for, or what is its purpose or end? The answer to this question, in the case of law, is that law directs us towards the common good. This answer directly connects to the formal cause of law as rational. The good is the end which reason seeks to obtain in its action. And I'm going to come back to this point in a moment. As such, if an ordinance is of reason, it must, by definition and in reality, somehow be directed towards the good. Because law primarily perfects the individual as an imperfect part of a broader community, an individual in relation to a greater whole, the good at issue is not primarily the good of the individual, but rather the common good. Now, of course, individuals achieving their individual goods do, at least per accidens, contribute to the good of the community. And the good of the community contributes to the good of an individual, as we were discussing briefly in the last presentation. Thomas need not stretch law itself to cover both the individual and the particular good, however, because his comprehensive approach to ethics includes teachings primarily directed towards the perfection of an individual, virtue. When considering law, however, the final cause of these ordinances of reason is to promote and bring about the common good. The efficient cause, next, answers another fundamental question, who or what made or produced something? The answer to this question, in the case of law, is identified in the phrase, made by him in charge of the community. This answer, again, builds on the answer to the question considered in the previous two articles. How so? Well, if law is directed towards the common good, then the only efficient cause capable of acting to achieve that end is one who somehow has a conception of what that good is or consists of. Because not every human being possesses the requisite awareness or intention to pursue the good of their community, not just any individual is competent to effect a law. In his answer, though, I should note, Thomas names two possible sources for the law that would fit this requirement. Either the people as a whole, that is, some kind of consensus decision, or an individual, importantly, so long as they are a legitimate authority. The material cause, finally, answers yet another fundamental question. What is something made out of? While we often think, and certainly when I teach the four causes, I use examples of material causes as physical stuff, wood, marble, flesh, bones, etc., Thomas frequently notes that there are many different senses of material causes. Some are physical, but some are not. In the case of law, what serves as the material cause is the particular ordinances or decrees that constitute a given legal system. In order for people to be held accountable for following these laws, however, they must be made known to them. You can't follow a rule unless you know it. The term Thomas uses for this making known of the law is promulgation. And thus, by extension, the very end of this definition indicates the material cause of law, promulgation. Having defined law itself, Thomas next turns directly in the following questions to consider the various kinds of law: the eternal, the natural, the human, and the divine. Now, today we are, of course, most interested in the natural law, but in Thomas's presentation, it soon becomes abundantly clear that we cannot grasp the natural law fully on its own, that is, apart from the eternal law. And for that matter, a full understanding of the natural law leads to a consideration of the human law. Given the constraints of time, I will set mostly to the side divine law, as this kind of law directly concerns Thomas's view of the supernatural or theological end of human life. Simply put, though, the divine law consists of various divinely revealed ordinances which direct us to union with God in heaven. Turning to the eternal law, though, the eternal law, simply put, is a manifestation of the divine reason, which governs the created order. Central to this view of the eternal law is the natural teleology of reality, in which even non-rational things have natural ends, which cooperate, in some way, consciously or not, with each other. It is this overarching, interconnected ordering, caused and sustained by God, that Thomas calls providence. In Article 2, Thomas turns to the natural law. While all things are included under the eternal law, among all the things that exist, there is something qualitatively different about human beings. Namely, we have reason and will. While it is true that all beings participate in divine providence in ways appropriate to their natures, there is something distinctive for Thomas about human participation in the eternal law. Here in Question 91, Article 2, Thomas then offers the following definition of natural law as nothing else than the rational creature's participation of the eternal law. A few questions later, he will return to the natural law and delineate some of the content of this particular kind of ordinance of reason, and we also are going to turn to that in just a moment. But before we do this, I do want to touch briefly on the human law. This kind of law is required for Thomas, first because human society, upon which we depend to live as human beings, require certain determinations to function which are not immediately known from reflecting on the eternal and the natural law. Think today, for example, of speed limits or income tax percentages. Simply reflecting on the nature of natural things doesn't reveal that to us, although to live in human society in this day and age, speed limits are important. Which is why Los Angeles is a lawless land. The human law is required because our participation in eternal law is imperfect, both in the sense of failing to fully measure up to what the natural law prescribes, but also insofar as every individual human being is an imperfect member of a greater whole. As we recall from Thomas's definition of law, the human law is the set of ordinances of reason which allow the human community to establish particular rules for human behavior. Thomas makes clear then in his presentation both that human law is necessary for human society and that human law depends on and cannot contradict the natural law. The natural law, similarly, is a specific manifestation of the underlying eternal law. Thus, Thomas's account of law is imbued with a realist ordered view of reality and nature. Let us now turn to consider then, in greater detail, the contents of the natural law. At the very beginning of Thomas's presentation of the principles of natural law, he invokes the distinction between speculative and practical reason. Reason itself, he explains, can be speculative or practical. Speculative reason is in play when we as intellectual beings seek to understand something. Practical reason is in play by contrast when we, as intellectual beings, strive to determine some course of action. While both speculative and practical reason are aspects of the same ability or the same power, that is, reason, they differ insofar as they allow us to achieve different ends, understanding, or action. Central to speculative reason is the notion of being. As Thomas states, quote, that which, before aught else, falls under apprehension is being, the notion of which is included in all things whatsoever a man apprehends. Thomas says this because in trying to understand something, in trying to come to understand anything, we are ultimately concerned with understanding its being. For that matter, we can only come to understand non-beings in a derivative or comparative sense, just as we can come to know that there is a hole in a sock not because the hole is something, but because there is an absence of what ought to be there, sock. While being itself is, in a way, a singular notion or concept, reflection on the meaning of this concept allows us to formulate the following principle. Wherefore, the first indemonstrable principle, Thomas states, is that the same thing cannot be affirmed and denied at the same time. You may recognize this as the principle of non-contradiction. This principle, upon which all subsequent understanding and reasoning depends, is based on the notion of being and not being, nothing more and nothing less. Similar to speculative reason, practical reason also has some singular concept or notion which is central to all of its activity. Instead of being, though, that's the notion of speculative reason, the central notion of the practical intellect is the good. As Thomas explains, now as being is the first thing that falls under the apprehension simply, so good is the first thing that falls under the apprehension of the practical reason, which is directed to action, since every agent acts for an end under the aspect of good, end quote. Just like the derivation of the principle of non-contradiction from the notion of being, so too the first principle of practical reason is derived directly from the notion of the good. Namely, good is that which all things seek after. This first principle, like the first principle of speculative reason, is nothing more and nothing less than an expansion of what the notion of good itself means. Because practical reason itself is ordered towards determining a course of action, though, not merely understanding, Thomas immediately converts this first principle of practical reason into a precept. That is, into a maxim or a command aimed at action. Good is to be done and pursued, and evil is to be avoided. So to recap, inasmuch as natural law is the work of practical reason, not primarily speculative, it takes as its starting point a first concept or notion, the good. Reflection on this concept or notion yields the first principle, a formulation of what this singular concept maintains. And from this formulated principle, one can convert it into the first precept or command of the natural law. Thus we have notion, principle, precept. From this initial progression, Thomas then goes on to identify a number of secondary precepts that follow upon this initial insight. The fact that Thomas is relying on his understanding of human nature, that is, the anthropology which maintains that the human being is both like and unlike all other natural beings, as we've just seen, is obvious in his threefold presentations of the precepts of the natural law. Each level of precept, which we'll turn to in just a sec, that he identifies are applications of the precept that good is to be done and pursued and evil is to be avoided. What distinguishes these precepts from the first is the increasing specificity of what good is to be done and pursued and what evil is to be avoided. So let's consider each of these in turn. First and most generally, there is good to be done and evil to be avoided inasmuch as we are substances. Thomas's view of human nature maintains that we are a particular kind of substance, and I'll get to the particular part in a moment. Inasmuch as we are a substance, there are goods to be pursued which are not unique to us, but we still do need to follow. Every substance, in a distinct and different way, seeks the preservation of its own being. Substances want to keep on substancing. But inasmuch as we are truly essentially substances, we are also directed towards pursuing the things that will allow us to continue existing and to avoid the things which do not. Second, and more specifically, there is good to be done and evil to be avoided inasmuch as we are not only substances, but animal substances. There are various goods and various evils that do not concern all substances, but do concern all animals. Human beings are a particular kind of animal, and while we are different from other animals, there is still an underlying commonality. As such, the natural law instructs us to pursue certain goods and avoid certain evils in a way appropriate to our animal nature. Third, and specifically, there is good to be done and evil to be avoided inasmuch as we are the specific kind of thing that we are, rational beings. It is at this level of precept that we arrive at ordinances which apply to human beings, but not to other kinds of animals, let alone other substances. While it is true that only these precepts that allow us to move beyond the precepts that pertain in appropriate different ways to other kinds of beings, it would be a mistake to think that these are the only precepts of natural law, let alone the only important ones. To recap, each level of precept is a more specific application of the first. Good is to be done and evil is to be avoided, inasmuch as one is a substance, inasmuch as one is an animal, and inasmuch as one is rational. Each of these levels of precept is helpful for us in determining what should or should not be done. But one could, at this point, reasonably object that the precepts prescribed by the natural law at each of these levels, even though they become more specific, they're still rather general. This poses something of a problem because human actions are always fundamentally particular. I do not act in a general way, but in particular instances, by choosing to do this or that action, or choosing not to do this or that action. It is in repeatedly doing this or that action that one can make a generalization. Thus, if the natural law, as a manifestation of practical reason, is going to be actually practical, we must go beyond these general levels and get down to particular or individual determinations. Now, this isn't really a problem. Thomas himself is well aware of this issue, and he addresses it shortly after presenting the precepts we just reviewed. He begins doing so in question 94, article 4, when he asks whether the natural law is the same in all men. In his reply, he distinguishes between what is common or more general and what is proper or more particular. The process of reasoning, both speculative and practical for him, involves moving from the general, such as all men are mortal or the good is to be done, down to the particular, Socrates is a man or this action is good. Thomas notes that practical reason, which by its nature deals with particulars, that is, the particular actions of which the moral life consists, admits of variability the more specific the determinations become. Thus, he argues that in the domain of practical reason, we must distinguish between the first and most general principle, various precepts that are more specific applications of this first principle or precept, the three we just talked about, which are still general, but more specific as you go, and finally, the particular actions that an individual should or should not perform. This distinction between the general first and general secondary precepts and the derived particular determinations leads Thomas to conclude that the natural law is, in one sense, the same for all, and in another sense, different, while not contradicting himself. The first and secondary precepts of the natural law are the same and unchanging. The tertiary, or as he calls them, derived precepts, may be different and even change. The particular actions that an individual should or should not perform may well be different for one individual than for another, or at one time or place than another. For example, there is the general precept, education of offspring. This is a good to be pursued in as much as we are animals. While this pertains, in some way or another, to all human beings, for that matter, to all animals, what this education consists of can, and arguably should, differ from one person to another, or from one time or place to another. Now, lest we fall into the subjectivist trap of maintaining that these actions, determined by and in relation to the individual subject, are of paramount importance, we must keep in mind Thomas's insistence that a particular action cannot violate the general principle. So not anything that an individual might determine is permissible as a derived precept are actually going to fly. Just saying it's natural law doesn't make it so. Only those determinations which are particular applications of the more general rule. Now, I promised at the beginning of this talk to answer the question of how to derive ought from is, and given that my time is approaching its end, I had better follow through on that promise. The naturalistic fallacy is often raised as an objection to natural law approaches to ethics. The very term natural law seems to couple the ought, or law, and the is from nature. But if we cannot derive an ought from an is, if we cannot derive law from nature, then natural law is at best an oxymoron. And at worst, it's a harmful contradiction that will lead people astray. Early inspiration for what has come to be known as the naturalistic fallacy can be found in David Hume's Treatise of Human Nature. Here, Hume maintains that ought claims are entirely different from is statements. Now, underneath this apparent denial of deriving ought from is a radically different notion of is. I should note, Alistair McIntyre denies this interpretation of Hume. For the purposes of this talk, I'll say this is at least an inspiration for many subsequent thinkers, and perhaps people who know more about McIntyre could bring that up in the Q&A. Underneath, then, this apparent denial of deriving ought from is a radically different notion of is. The Humean brand of empiricism, which maintains that our knowledge begins with and in many ways is limited to direct sense experience, leads him to jettison the idea that the human being is an individual of a metaphysical, natural kind. We are instead bundles of perception shaped by experience, habit, and sentiment. It should come as no surprise, then, that he throws out the baby of the moral ought with the bathwater of nature and natural teleology. The facticity of human life, however, as we have seen, is decidedly not the is at play in the Thomistic derivation of ought. If we are to evaluate the morality of any given action, then there must be some way of bridging the fact, that is, that something is the case, and the value we assign to it. Or perhaps, and more precisely, there must be some way of assessing what is in light of what can or ought to be. This derivation of ought from is depends on an accurate view of the nature of what is. The stakes here are high. Our flourishing is inextricably connected to our nature. Thus, the denial of one leads to the loss of the other. And thus, in conclusion, those who are concerned with what we ought to do would do well to return to the Thomistic account of what is. Many thanks.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.